Looking at true spirituality, we have basing this my meditations on the book by Dr. Francis Schaeffer. The question before us is what the Christian life, true spirituality, really is, and how may it be lived in the 20th century or now in the 21st century. We've been looking at the freedom from the bondage of sin. This is salvation. And now looking at the freedom from the results of the bonds of sin. This is sanctification. The outline, freedom from the bondage of sin, basic consideration, biblical unity, and true spirituality, and daily practice being the fruitful bride. Second, the freedom from the results of the bonds of sin. We're looking at the freedom from conscience. And then secondly, now, freedom for our thought life, the concept and importance of the thought life. And now dealing with the substantial healing of psychological problems. The word psychology comes from the Greek word for the soul, the mind, the will, the emotions, and the higher part of the natural man. So we looked last time about man being broken by sin, broken in his relationship to God, broken in his relationship to one another, but for this study, broken within himself. And that's the difficulty, man not understanding who he is. We want to look now tonight for the search for being, because broken man has no idea why he's here. He doesn't know what this is all about. So basically, I just put down all my notes here, so I'll just try to get through this, and you can read it if you can't quite understand me. Broken man is the unsaved man, man broken in his relationship to God and himself. Broken man has appealed to an exaggerated view of his own ability, an exaggerated view of his own rational thought to deliver him from his subordinate relationship to God. He thinks, I don't have to be subordinate to God, I'll stand on my own. England and Europe, especially in the 1800s, tried this escape. Brother Jeb was sharing with us about the text issue. This all occurred at the beginning and during the 1800s when German rationalism said, we don't need God, we have our mind. And then evolution came around and said, man evolved, therefore all religion, including Christianity, just evolved. Therefore, the Bible text should have evolved. And they went looking for a text like that. They tried this escape. The myth that they called of the devil became the new hero, as the one who would not allow God to restrict his will. The rereading of Paradise Lost, Milton's Paradise Lost, was that the real hero here was the devil who wouldn't let God push him around. In our day, called postmodernism, where we got over the hope that science would answer all the questions, man in general has come to a cynical and mocking attitude about man's ability and genius. Today, the movies are about the apocalypse. They're about post-apocalyptic life. Nobody in postmodernism is expecting science to answer all of our questions, but just to add to our problems. Today's man turns to living according to nature, rejecting rational thought, rejoicing in being an animal, or turning to an admittedly irrational mysticism, rejecting material rational thought for relief from the internal arguments. So we find the two sides of it. Just be the animal that you are, that evolution made you, or go into some mysticism, occultism, and you'll find your meaning there. Both of these reactions represent a breaking with who man really is. This is the sad part about where we are today. Deep inside, God's witness of conscience keeps man from escaping his grasp of right and wrong. An animal doesn't worry about what's right and wrong. Occultism says we're above right and wrong. But man's heart says, I feel guilty. Romans 2:15, which show the work of the law written in their hearts, their conscience also bearing witness, or the conscience witnessing with them, and their thoughts the meanwhile, or between themselves, accusing or else excusing one another. So the thoughts inside, the conscience doing this work. And they can't escape that. That's who they are. That's how God made us. So broken man has tried to reason his way out of God-ordained morality by rejecting both God and morality. I don't believe in God, therefore I'm not going to accept his morality. Friedrich Nietzsche was famous for this. He was the one who said, God is dead. And what he meant by that is there never was a God, but our need for the philosophy of God is past. We're greater than that now. And so he declared, don't try to hang on to that God-ordained morality when you said there is no God. Hedonism, giving yourself in to every desire of the flesh, preaches living without any restrictions except personal desire. The only thing to guide you is what you want. Most people, however, find within themselves the hesitancy and even repugnance of such a life. Giving themselves into that may sound interesting, but getting into it is just uncleanness. And most people can't give themselves to that. Then we have sociological morality. And it says, of course, there is no God. Of course, there is no outside moral code. But you should live within the morality accepted by the culture in which you live. This usually fails because that philosophy can't answer why any one individual should limit his desires. Why should I bow to the culture? My culture is accidental, evolutionary. Why should I listen to that? Benjamin Franklin, for instance, rejected biblical revelation and defined his own system of moral self-improvement. But he found that it failed. His own system failed because his system gave him no power to accomplish what it demanded. It just said, be perfect. He didn't know how to be perfect. Sigmund Freud, the inventor of psychoanalysis and sort of the father of all psychiatry and psychology, 1856 to 1939, he tried to redefine man in his mechanical idea of mind and emotion. He taught that love was an illusion. It's a chemical thing in the brain. That physical sexuality supplied everything necessary. You don't need to feel love. The animal of us just needs sexuality. But it wasn't good enough for his own life. In his own personal relationship with his fiance, he wrote, quote, when you come to me, little princess, love me irrationally. He says, I know it doesn't make any sense, but that's what I want. What he proclaimed to the world failed him in his own real life relationship. Broken man believes the devil's lie, you shall be as gods. The word is Elohim, one of the titles of God. So man gathers himself up, steps out in his life, assuming he can transcend all limitations. Nothing can stop me, he says. Just listen to the motivational speakers. Nothing can stop you. Rebellious man demands unlimited freedom. Yet everything in this life shoves a wall into his face and says, you shall not pass. Right? So we find the X sports, you know, extreme sports. So he dares death. He damages himself. He runs into the wall. And I was trying to find out the source of this. Two things can't exist in the same place at the same time. It ends up being called the Pauli exclusion principle. And technically it says two identical fermions, particles with half integer spin, cannot occupy the same quantum state simultaneously. So all of you know that, right? I don't even know what I said, but you can't have two things in the same place at the same time. So when you run into the wall, it's going to hurt. Probably not the wall. Hurt you. So man's philosophy, reaching everywhere it can, trying to break out of subordination to God. But he ends up, he has only two choices. He may return to his place as a creature before his personal creator, or he can fall into a lower position. He can act like one of the other creation, animal or plant. When God created man in his own image and offered him a place within the triune family, he put him in an amazingly privileged position. It's a weak and futile pretense of unlimited freedom that's just pitiful and ridiculous. This is, I always remember the picture of my wife's family when they were little, and Larry, the brother Larry, who grew up kind of big and strong and so on, he always imagined that he was big and strong, and so I have a picture of him in his t-shirt doing this, you know, and he has these little tiny string arms, and the t-shirt's hanging off his little arms, you know, and it's like, you know, look at me and be afraid, you know, and everybody goes, that looks silly. This is man before God. This is the ant standing before the elephant saying, you can't do anything to me. John the Baptist had it right. He declared his position in life and ministry. He must increase, but I must decrease. It is your pride, your elevation, greater than you really are, that alienates God. God resists the proud, but he gives grace to the humble. Modern, rebellious, and broken man takes his place among the instinctive animals, or completely rational, among the computer machines. Sin robs him of who he really is. We see this in Ephesians 4:17b-19. Gentiles, referring to unsaved Gentiles, walk in the vanity of their mind, having the understanding darkened, being alienated from the life of God, which is the source of true life, alienated from the life of God through the ignorance that is in them. They're exercising their ignorance in pride of exalting over God because of the blindness or the hardness of their heart, who, being past feeling, have given themselves over unto lasciviousness to work all uncleanness with greediness. At the heart of all this rebellion is, I want to do what I want to do. I want to do anything that feels good to me. Uncleanness with greediness. When man chose to refuse God's loving warning in the Garden of Eden, he believed the devil's lie, you shall be as gods, you shall be like Elohim. That gives you infinite freedom. God's sad duty of explaining the reality of the consequences reveals man's brokenness from God, actually brokenness from nature itself, from his fellow man, and even from himself. So God expelled man from the beautiful garden, the scene of their sweet fellowship, brokenness from God. God cursed nature with thorns and thistles, making daily labor harder. So alienation, brokenness from God's universe. Childbirth, pain, and dying shows man's separation from his own body. Today, psychiatrists and psychologists try to heal the broken man. And I think they have a real desire to do that. They just don't know how. He attempts to reintegrate, put back together the Humpty Dumpty pieces, internal brokenness, trying to put man back together. The problem is that the counselor, by virtue of what he believes, and perhaps more importantly, what he does not believe, the counselor himself cannot relate the damaged person as he really is to the personal creator God. That's not where he's looking, see? So he can't deal with man as he really is. He must deal with him as a lesser being. He will try to train him as an animal, behaviorism, or treat him chemically as a plant that needs insecticide or fertilizer. Give you the proper drug to make your evolutionary mind act right. Some of them, in fact, I was reading about this, pretend to find healing by overlaying reality with a fantasy world. They try hypnosis to trick the mind into accepting himself, or they try to guide him into irrational mysticism. They're saying, we don't really believe in this mysticism, but if they do, I was reading about a man who worked with American Indians, and he says he uses all kinds of totems and all these things because it spoke to them. If they accepted it, maybe it would work. They may use the word God, or they may use the word, speak of universal purpose, but they offer only temporary help because he does not take real life into consideration. He's not dealing with the real person. So, all of that to say, is there in today's world a real answer to psychological problems stemming from our brokenness and sin? And all psychological problems stem from our brokenness and sin. The answer is yes. But we must follow the pattern of our salvation experience. Take your broken mind, your broken soul, to God by means of Christ on the cross. How do I do that? Well, fully admit your sin, your desires, and your weaknesses. Say it like it really is. You come before God and you say, here's my problem. Hand all of it to Jesus to bear for you on the cross. It's as though he takes it from you and then he nails it to his cross with his own hands and feet. Colossians 2:14, blotting out the handwriting of ordinances that was against us, which was contrary to us, and took it out of the way, doing what? Nailing it to his cross. So, your sin and your guilt for sin is real. Today, we only hear about guilt feelings. Since they don't believe in real morality, they don't believe in real guilt. It's only guilt feelings. But your guilt for your sin is real, and it demands the consequences of death. You deserve death because of it. You have to admit that, see? I deserve death, but hand that to Jesus for him to make the payment. Now, stay to see him take your sin and die. See him close his eyes in death. The payment is made. The very Son of God had to die to take your place of death. And as this, of course, affects you, watch in your tears as the lifeless body is taken to the tomb and the stone is rolled in place. The deed is done. The payment is complete. Now thank God for removing the great consequences of death, which is the result of being severed, plucked out of God's, the God of life. Remember Jesus on the cross. He had to cry, "Why hast thou forsaken me?" This is that brokenness from God. He took your separation. He took your brokenness with God. So this allows you to be restored. Once you've dealt with the guilt and the sin, now you can retrain your thinking. It's actually been dealt with by Christ. So you don't have to do anything about that. That's been handled. But now you have to retrain your thinking. Romans 12:2. Be not conformed to this world, but be transformed. And how do you do that? By sneezing. No. By the renewing of your mind, that you may prove, may put to the test, what is that good and acceptable and perfect will of God. So, you've got to actually understand who and what you are. You need to see how you're related to God, how you're related to the world around you, to nature, how you're related to your fellow man, and how you are related to yourself. Instead of traveling the endless and vicious circle of trying and failing, of feeling better and then worse, instead, straighten that out. See the straight line path of progress. I deserve death. I give that to Christ. He handles it. And now I can be better. Are you right now not who you wish you were? The question is this: which way are you moving? Is it in that circle, that never-ending circle? I wish I hadn't done that. What if I'd only done this? What if this, you know? I don't think I can ever get over it. I don't think I can forgive myself. That's a vicious circle. Which way are you moving? Are you moving in progress? Do you see that you are better, and this from God's point of view, than you were before? That is progress. You say, well, I'm not anywhere near where what I should be. That's okay, as long as you're taking steps to get there. That happens after the sin is dealt with and you retrain your thinking to be conformed to the image of Christ. Envision on down the line. Envision that in the time to come, you will be conformed to the image of Jesus himself. You will be revealed to the world as sons of God. You'll be clothed in gloriousness, even as Christ. You'll be sitting upon the throne, Christ's own throne, he says. So, how about the guilt feelings? Well, learn to discern between man's expectations of you and what God wants you to become. Sometimes people put their own expectations on you. Parents will do this. A husband might do it. A wife. Bosses, co-workers. Preachers may do that. And congregations may do that. Back to the preacher. We have our expectations of you. They may pour their expectations on you and create a false guilt. Turn that all over to God. Bring what problems you know to God in frank confession of sin. and he will begin the process of renewing the broken parts. As he heals the parts that are known to you, he also heals the hidden parts that you haven't quite figured all out yet. The false psychological guilt that makes us feel unworthy before others is revealed either as true guilt, because I did something wrong, for moving away from God, or as merely an illusion set before us by man's expectation. But here's the thing we need to understand about that expectation. Maybe you were brought up with an expectation of excellence that you were never able to live up to. But was that a right and wrong thing? Was that something you could say, I bow to God in this thing? Or was it, I only make B's and I was required to make A's, you know? Their demands of who they think we should be are not binding on us. Only God gets to say what is right and what is wrong. Man doesn't get to say that. Man does not have to set an expectation for you that's aside from what God says. It's not binding on us. Listen to two verses. Romans 14:4. Paul asks, "Who art thou that judgest another man's servant?" You say, "Look, I'm a servant of God. I don't know who you think you are, but you're judging another man's servant. To his own master he standeth or falleth. Yea, he shall be holden up, for God is able to make him stand." God is able to make me stand if I follow him. I don't have to feel guilty about not meeting all your expectations. Paul dealt with this, being criticized. 1 Corinthians 4:3. "But with me, it is a very small thing that I should be judged of you. I criticize you." Yeah, well, that's not a big deal. "Or of man's judgment." It's not even man's day of judgment for me, see. "Yea, I judge not mine own self," knowing that I can always find that I could have done things better. But that's not the question. Did I do what God asks, and did I do it with the proper motive? So this lesson dealing with the search for being, finding out who we really are, and entering back into the relationship under God. This is the healing of, substantial healing of psychological problems.